Hey, this is Jen Johans at FilmIntuition.com and Film Intuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen. Hey, everyone. Just a quick announcement before we begin. Recently, I kicked off a new short video feature that's kind of a companion to the podcast called Watch with Jen Bonus Rex. You can find it right now on patreon.com/filmintuition, and the first few videos will also be uploaded to my Instagram, which is at filmintuition. These are going to be just quick few-minute episodes. I think the first one's just like 5 minutes long, where I recommend a film that's a little bit older. It might be foreign, obscure, something most people aren't really talking about now that I'm hoping you will love. I've always enjoyed hearing from listeners and readers who are looking for more creative film recommendations because they're kind of getting tired of the new content that kind of you forget as soon as you watch, essentially. So they're looking for more substantive viewing, and I'm hoping these will help you. So you can check those out on our patreon.com/filmintuition. And I'm going to keep the first few unlocked to everyone so you guys can all enjoy it. And then in the future, they are going to be for subscribers only. The supporters for the podcast that pay as little as a dollar a month to try to keep us ad-free. So I want to say thank you to them. So again, that's what we're doing. Now let's get into this week's episode. Today, I am so pleased to welcome a new guest to the podcast, a very, very talented writer whose work I've enjoyed on Vulture and elsewhere for years. We have Jen Chaney. Jen Chaney is a TV critic and a writer for Vulture and New York Magazine. She's also the author of the book, As If, The Complete Oral History of Clueless. She previously worked at the Washington Post and has contributed to the New York Times, Vanity Fair, and other publications. Well, Jen, I want to thank you so much for doing this. I've always enjoyed talking to you on Twitter. It was really cool. I mean, first of all, a fellow Jen, but one that likes tennis, and we would sometimes bond over liking like rhythmic swimming in the Olympics and things. And you have wonderful taste in pop culture. So, Jen, such a pleasure. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. I'm so excited to be here. Yay, rhythmic gymnastics. If you didn't watch it, if you can find YouTube videos of it, it's just, as you know, Jen, it's spectacular.
Yes. And oh my goodness, the swimming and the masks, and we were fangirls for the whole France team. And yeah, there was so much exciting stuff to be watching. And also, I get really excited when I see you and Roxana Haddadi, who you work with on Vulture, talking about tennis, because it seems like probably there's three people on Twitter that like tennis.
So no, I know of at least seven or eight.
Ooh, okay. Seven or eight. Sounds good.
And I don't know if you feel this way, too, but like knowing that Rafael Nadal is retiring has just hit me very, very hard. Like the idea that I won't watch him play anymore is so sad to me.
Yeah. And we lost, Andy Murray and now Dominic Thiem. And it's like, oh my gosh, the old guard. Yeah. But Rafa, first Roger, and, you know, all those pictures of them crying together. And you're like, it's very, I love you, man, which we're going to be talking about later.
Yes.
Exactly. Just tying it all together. But Jen, what do you have coming up? Anything exciting?
Well, continuing to write for Vulture as I always do, but also Vulture has an annual event every year called Vulture Festival.
Yes.
Which is happening in a couple weeks. Well, it's November, let me make sure I have the right date, 16th and 17th in Los Angeles. And we're going to have a bunch of exciting panels. I will be moderating, as I always do, the Henry Winkler acting lessons panel, which is just an extraordinary thing to watch. Like, he is legitimately a great acting coach. Like, I have watched him work with someone on a scene and then the actor just goes somewhere else with it that they never thought that they could.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah. So I'll be doing that. I'm also moderating a reunion of You're the Worst, which is
such
one
a
of
good
the
show.
Great shows of the, I guess, 2010s. So yeah, and there's a bunch of other exciting things happening there too. So definitely come check it out if you can.
Oh, that's so exciting. I can't wait to hear more about that panel. I'm hoping some of the clips might wind up on YouTube or something later, because I always enjoyed You're the Worst. Aya Cash, amazing. I'm glad she's on a show again now with the franchise. Her mom is a brilliant poet. And a past guest on the show, Allison Anders' daughter, Tiffany Anders, wonderful music supervisor, worked on You're the Worst. That show had the best needle drops.
Terrific music. Absolutely great music. I mean, I hadn't watched it in a while, and I went back to rewatch it for the purposes of the panel, and it's even better than I remember.
Oh, that's so good. I know, because we really don't have these kind of shows much anymore. So that's really cool. Yeah. And talking about, you know, great music and stuff, some of these movies we're going to be discussing, like Clueless, of course, you know, also Wet Hot American Summer has some great musical nods. I Love You, Man. But before we jump into the movies, we decided that Paul Rudd would be a great topic to go into. Jen, of course, has written the oral history of Clueless, as told by Amy Heckerling, the cast and crew, called As If. And it was released, it looks like, in 2015. So,
yes. To the 20th anniversary. And now we're coming up on the 30th.
That's just... blows my mind. I remember seeing it in the theater, and I think it was like right before I was starting high school it came out, so kind of amazing.
Perfect timing.
Yes, exactly. And Rudd is such a wonderful actor. He's somebody like we grew up watching, of course, and you know, the eternal fountain of youth, with you know, that you can't talk about Paul Rudd without wondering about Dorian Gray, and this man does not age. Just named, you know, sexiest man alive by People a couple years ago. Kind of historically known to be a nice guy, and do roles in Friends pictures and stuff where he's joked like he doesn't know if he got paid. He just kind of showed up and did it for fun and for loyalty and for friendship. So I always think he brings something really interesting to movies. You never know if he's going to do drama or comedy. So what is it about Paul Rudd, Jen, that drew you to him first? Do you remember like an early performance that stood out?
Well, I think like most people, the first time I became aware of him was in Clueless, which was not technically the first movie he shot. The first movie he shot was Halloween 6, I believe. But Clueless came out first. So it was his first, you know, credit, really big credit.
Yeah.
And I mean, on a completely surface, vapid level, I just thought he was super cute.
Yeah.
But there's a quality that he has that I feel like runs through all of his roles, which is, it's not just that he's handsome, but there's something, you were talking about him being nice. It's that, but there's something, there's just something about the way he comes across that you feel like he's trustworthy and a good person, no matter who he's playing, even when he's playing a complete asshole.
Yeah. That's a good point.
That it kind of undergirds all of his performances, and you can't, I mean, likable is such a terrible overused adjective, but it really applies to him in a big way.
It does. Yeah. Like you kind of want to give him the benefit of the doubt, even when he's playing somebody monstrous. And, you know, I think he is fun. All actors love playing villains from time to time, of course. And, but yeah, I think there is something approachable. I mean, another stereotypical phrase that's overused with actors is like, you know, boy next door, or somebody you would have known growing up, that kind of thing. And you do get that, you know, of course, movie stars are like better looking than your average bear, but it does seem like somebody that you kind of know or you trust. Mm-hmm. And that is Paul Rudd. Yes. And of course, Clueless is the movie that, just like you, that I remember first seeing him in. And yeah, he was adorable. It's such a great film. I love the Jane Austen novels, and you know, I think most people do, but this was like the peak Jane Austen time. You know, we had Sense and Sensibility and that Pride and Prejudice miniseries, and then this one. And I remember when I was going to college briefly at Agnes Scott College, my professor who taught a course in Jane Austen was saying, of all the movies that were based on, she thought that Clueless was the best Jane Austen, because she said it was in the spirit of Austen, making up phrases and words, and it was fun and positive and frothy. And so she said, as much as she enjoyed the other movies, even Emma with Gwyneth Paltrow, which came out around this time, Clueless was her favorite. So did you love it right away too?
I did. And I've had similar conversations with other professors and Jane Austen scholars who have said the exact same thing. And I think, you know, not everybody realized it was Emma when it came out. You're obviously very wise and smart. And so you probably knew, but Paul Rudd didn't even know. Like he said, he was at maybe the after party after the premiere. And one of the producers was like, "Hey, isn't it cool that this is based on Emma?" And he's like, "Yeah, what?" Like he had no clue. And I think actually that's a strength of the film is you can enjoy it on its own terms. If you don't know that it's based on Emma, it's fine. But once you do know that and you really start looking at the text side by side with the movie, it really brings home how brilliant it is and how Amy was able to, you know, take carriage rides and replace them with people trying to get around LA. And it just worked so perfectly. That was one of my favorite parts of writing the book was just looking at the Jane Austen and the Amy Heckerling side by side.
Oh, that's so good. Yeah, I read, now it probably was pulled right from your book, but Amy Heckerling was talking about when 20th Century Fox tapped her for it. You know, she was told she can't write about nerds. She needed to write about popular people, popular kids. And then, of course, they bailed. They didn't want a female-centric script. And luckily, Paramount and Scott Rudin saw the brilliance that was in this script. But she was talking about that when she was looking at her career and which character had kind of stuck out for her in Fast Times at Ridgemont High, it was Spicoli. And it wasn't just because he was a stoner and saying like bonehead things and, you know, quotable quotes, but he was positive and happy and people wanted to be around him. And so that's kind of what she did with Cher and Alicia Silverstone. And like, what a perfect marriage of actress with role. I can't imagine anyone else, even though when you read and you're like, oh, Reese Witherspoon or other people who were auditioning or considered around this time period. Angelina Jolie was another one, but my goodness, I mean, Alicia is perfect. Paul Rudd, I know Ben Affleck was one of the people. There were a bunch in this little group of actors, but yeah, it's hard to imagine anyone else in these roles.
Right. I mean, Angelina Jolie is obviously a fantastic actress, but one of the things Amy said about her, and I agree, she's like, she felt a little too knowing.
And ooh, that's a good comment. Yeah.
Cher is very naive and, you know, clueless, as the title tells you.
Yes.
And that's what the journey is. It's her kind of learning to look at the world outside of herself and not be so self-centered and shallow.
Yeah.
And, yeah, Alicia Silverstone just had all the right qualities for it. You're right. Nobody else could do that except her. She's just perfect.
Yeah. And listening to you talk about how like they didn't even know they were doing Emma or a couple of the actors didn't, including Paul Rudd. I was thinking about this time period too. We also had those Shakespeare adaptations and Rudd was in Romeo and Juliet, the Baz Luhrmann movie that came out after this. And so it was really kind of creative time to take these classic stories and put them together. But this one, kind of everything worked. What was it about Clueless that you first gravitated to, do you think?
I mean, for me, I'm a little bit older than you are. And we had so many movies, teen movies in the 80s. Like, obviously, that was a huge phenomenon. And then it felt like there in the early 90s, it kind of quieted down a little bit in that regard.
Yeah.
And so when Clueless came out, it felt like a return to that. Like my initial like gut response was like, oh, this reminds me of the movies that I liked when I was younger.
Yes.
That were about high school students, even when I wasn't in high school yet. I still,
oh my gosh, I watched all of them. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was what struck me first. And then it's just such a lively movie. Like visually, it's just so beautiful to look at from, you know, the sets and Bill Pope, who was the DP, who was the coolest dude on earth. Mona May's costumes are incredible. Like they just introduced so many things to the culture and to the lexicon that, you know, in 1995, we couldn't even appreciate it yet. Now it's like, it's just ingrained in us. It is one of those movies that has such staying power. And that, as you know, people still quote and it's memed constantly. And I think there's a timeless quality to it, maybe because it was an adaptation of Jane Austen, because the story works in any time. Amy really proved that.
And when it comes to Rudd, do you have a favorite scene, line delivery moment that you think really showed, wow, this guy is interesting? Beyond, of course, everyone immediately being like, ooh, he's cute, but realizing this actor is interesting and somebody that we might need to pay attention to in the future.
I mean, I just thought that the way that he kind of represents a stereotypical, in some ways, Gen X viewpoint. He's like a little bit older than Cher, and he's, you know, he's always reading and criticizing her. Nietzsche, and criticizing her for, you know, watching Ren and Stimpy and Beavis and Butthead. And I liked the chemistry that he had with Silverstone. And, you know, I think like a lot of people, I thought they had that big scene where they're sitting on the staircase and he kisses her for the first time.
Oh, yeah.
And he's lovely in that scene. And at the time, his manager told him he didn't kiss her right. Can you imagine saying that to someone after
that
they had
is
shot a
crazy.
Scene?
That is crazy. I thought it was a beautiful kiss. Also, they hadn't kissed before. It was more natural. Yeah.
Totally. He did nothing wrong. But
no.
But that's what he was told. And I think he kind of like maybe took that with him to some extent. And I was like, I don't know who your manager was, but they are awful.
They are. What did the manager want? Him to just like deliver a Gone with the Wind style kiss? Or
I don't know. I really don't know.
Because they were nervous. I mean, you know, just like it's a first kiss and they have so much history together. So I love that. And I think for me, like revisiting the movie last night, I've seen a million times, but just the way he looks at her and listens in scenes is interesting. Like sometimes, you know, he wants her to do better. Sometimes just his reaction to something she's doing, whether it's playing with her hair or saying something ridiculous, just sort of watching him in the scene with her is really good, because I know sometimes whether they're in the same shot or not, like actors like Michael Douglas has talked about, sometimes, you know, you can really tell who's a good actor when they're not the one on camera. Like, what are they giving back to you? And I think Rudd, there is that chemistry like you were talking about, and it really pays off.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
Yeah, I love Clueless. Is there anything else you wanted to talk about with this era before we get to Wet Hot American Summer, like from Clueless onward, or any stories you remember?
Well, I have a story. I don't know what you want to do with it because it's sort of a non sequitur, but to me, it was interesting.
Sure.
The night before they filmed the Mighty Mighty Boss Tone scene in Clueless, Paul Rudd had gone out to dinner at a diner in LA with a friend. And for some reason, they were having a conversation about policing in Los Angeles and how he imagined it must be so difficult because LA is so spread out. And anyway, they had their meal. He goes to his car and he gets held up at gunpoint. Someone fired a gun like right near his head. Like,
oh my God.
In the middle of this movie, theoretically. And he let them steal what he had, which was his backpack that had a Discman in it and his copy of the Clueless script with all his notes in it. So, and then he talked about the next day, he had to just go and like pretend to be at a concert. And he was sort of like,
how shell-shocked. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I thought that was interesting too, because Cher gets held up in the movie and it just felt like life imitating art in a terrible, terrible way.
Yeah.
But I tell that story because the idea of not having him around to do all these things that we're about
terrifying.
To talk about is terrifying.
Very terrifying. And also what I like about your story too is it shows that, you know, when people watch these movies, they just sometimes assume like actors are the characters they're playing, or that the experience sometimes, you know, this sounds like it was a really good experience overall, the film, like people got along and stuff. But, you know, sometimes these movies are hard to make, and it really just shows that sadly, he had this horrible thing happen and then he had to go and be light and airy.
I mean, maybe things don't happen to that extreme where somebody almost gets killed the night before, but like
we hope not.
Right. But certainly I'm sure every actor has multiple stories about having to pull it together and keep it together in scene when other stuff is going on in their private life. But so what's interesting to me about after Clueless, Paul Rudd wanted to go back to New York, and he wanted to do theater. And his reps at the time were so confused. They're like, this is launching you really well. Yeah. And obviously, like you mentioned, he did Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet after that, but he did do some theater. And I feel like that quality that we were talking about before, his sort of underlying decency, trustworthiness, goodness, it Hollywood didn't know what to do with it at first. And I feel like what happened to Paul Rudd was the same thing that kind of happened to James Marsden initially, where here's this very handsome guy. Let's cast him as the boyfriend who's not as good as Leonardo DiCaprio or in the cute rom-com or whatever. And so when eventually he did Wet Hot American Summer in 2001, as weird as it sounds now, people were like, oh, hey, Paul Rudd's really funny. It was like people didn't realize how funny he was because he hadn't gotten a chance to show that side of himself. And I feel like Wet Hot was sort of the first indication for those who weren't in the know of how good he was as a comedian.
Yes. Yeah. And he's talked about, like, I don't know if I got paid for this movie, but it took like 3 years to raise the money. I think I read it was like $1.8 million, but they said it was $5 million just to try to like get a distributor to take them seriously, which is hilarious. Nobody really knew what to do with this movie, and it's kind of been a cult hit or word of mouth hit, which sort of makes sense for what it is, because it was inspired by like Dazed and Confused and all of these Meatballs and summer camp type movies, or the ones that take place in a short period of time. I love that when they do that, because sometimes you can meet somebody really fast and then life changes, or you bond with people really quickly. Whether it's in a week, like Lost in Translation, or in a day, like Dazed and Confused. And this one's a blast. Do you remember when you first saw it?
I do. I don't know if you watched The State on MTV when it was
on. Oh my God, I loved The State. Yeah.
And that was what I was, why I was initially completely interested in this movie, because David Wayne, who was in The State, directed it. He co-wrote it with Michael Showalter, also in The State. Tons of people who are on that show were in this as well. Ken Marino, Joe Latrulio. And then on top of it, especially in retrospect, Amy Poehler, Bradley Cooper, Janine Garofalo, like just an incredible cast. Oh my goodness,
David Hyde Pierce. And
And my recollection, and I'm curious if you remember the same, is that critics at the time just did not get it, because no offense to everyone, but they were baby boomers and they didn't necessarily watch The State. They didn't have that frame of reference for the kind of humor that they do.
Yeah.
But I thought it was completely hilarious. I loved it. And I thought Paul Rudd especially was, he wasn't one of the stars. His role was a little bit smaller, but he did everything with it. The scene that is probably the most famous is when Janine Garofalo is telling him to clean up in the cafeteria, and he just makes a literal meal out of that, just flinging himself around like, oh, yes, I don't want to pick up this chair. that scene is like, I think anyone who wants to be a physical comedian type of actor should watch that.
Yeah. You know, what's weird is I loved The State, but I don't really remember the first time I saw this. I don't know if I was busy that day or I just didn't get it, but it kind of like, went in one eye out the other, like I completely forgot. And then years later, I saw it again and it just clicked. And so I'm kind of wondering, maybe for some critics, if it worked like that. Like, it did take them a while, like you were saying too, like baby boomers reviewing something that they don't get or they don't have a frame of reference for. And that might have been it. But yeah, it was, I think it played better when you kind of know what you're watching. Because at first, you might be thinking it's just like a traditional camp movie, and it gets increasingly like that scene where they go to town and it starts out just normal. And then by the end, they're all like having heroin overdose, like they're in, permanent midnight basically by the end of that sequence. You're like, what am I watching? Yeah, something like that. And then they go back and it's normal. Or, oh my God, the cook,
The talking.
You don't know what you're watching. Oh, Molly Shannon kills me too, with
all her kids giving her advice about her divorce. Amazing.
Yes. Yeah. So it's one that I think the more you see it, the more you know, you enjoy this movie. I know Kristen Bell was a huge fan. She talked about watching it like hundreds of times. And I do think this one does benefit from rewatches for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. It gets funnier the more you watch it.
Yeah. And he's so good at being like the worst boyfriend. and just how funny it is by the end. You know, like he's made out with everybody. Oh, you taste like a burger. That scene with the Elizabeth Banks just kills me. Yes.
Yeah, he does do a lot of sloppy kissing, especially with Elizabeth Banks in that film, and complete absolute neglect. Like one of his campers actually drowns. And
oh God, I know.
And another one,
he throws him in the
one who saw the drowning. They drive him and just chuck him out of a van.
Yeah.
Oh, what a great film.
I never went to, did you ever go to camp? Like, was this a movie?
Only to outdoor ed in sixth grade, which was like a week of sleepaway camp, but I didn't go in the summers. No,
I did Girl Scout camp, but I think it was like one or two nights basically. And that was about it. So I've kind of always watched these thinking, did I miss something big here? But yeah. So the energy of this one is just crazy. And this sort of did make people go, Paul Rudd is funny. And it was it the same year or around the same time he did Anchorman, of course?
It was a little bit before Anchorman.
Okay.
Anchorman was 2004, but it was like the beginning of him starting to move much more directly into comedy. Because once he did Anchorman, then it was like the 40-Year-Old Virgin, and he started doing all the, you know, the Apatow movies. And he worked a lot, again, with the state people. He was in The Baxter and you know, some of their other films. So I do feel like that movie kind of changed the trajectory.
Yes, that's a good point.
What he and the other thing I admire about him, and I alluded to this when we were talking about the theater, is that he really does seem to be guided by what he wants to do. He's not.
Yes.
If somebody gives him advice, he'll take it in, but he's not going to like not follow his own instincts. And I really appreciate that.
Yeah. And I think you made a really excellent point when you're talking about his collaborators, because he is someone who I think when he strikes up a friendship or enjoys working with them, they do show up and they want to work together again and again. And you do see that like later we're going to get to Our Idiot Brother. And, you know, you have some of the actresses that he's worked with before. This was also around the time he was on Friends, if I remember correctly. And before that, you know, he had done Object of My Affection with Jennifer Aniston. And then he wound up working with her a bunch of times and kind of bringing her into the Wayne universe before. So it was kind of a blend of there was the Wayne people, there were the Jesse Peretz people, and then the Judd Apatow people. And they kind of started to, you know, kind of commingle. And it was interesting.
Yeah, it was
they
a big Venn diagram.
Yes.
With Paul Rudd in the middle.
that's it. Yeah. I think Rudd was the connector and kind of all of a sudden they cross paths and like, oh, you're fun to work with. And later he wound up, you know, co-creating Party Down, which hilarious. And you can kind of see that maybe coming from this experience.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Did we talk about Anchorman?
Anchorman. Oh my God. Yes. I think he is so funny in that. You know, I rewatched it because it came out in 4K this summer recently. And you find a different thing you love every time you watch that movie, you know, whether it's the leather bound books. But for me watching it this time, it's the Sex Panther scene with Paul Rudd. And like,
yeah, 60% just, of the time.
Yes.
100% of the time.
It's so funny. Yeah. And I think he weaponizes that charm and his appearance to great effect.
Yeah. So here's a movie that the first time I saw it, I was kind of disappointed because my expectations, perhaps like the people who saw Wet Hot American Summer, were not aligned with what this movie was going to be. So I wasn't meeting it where it was.
Yeah.
For some reason in my brain, maybe I'd been watching too much of The Daily Show. I thought it was going to be more
about journalism?
Of a satire of the news business, which it is at certain times.
Yeah.
But mostly it's just a dumb, silly, funny movie. And I wasn't as prepared for that. But then once I understood what it was, I'm like, oh, okay, this movie is great. And I was rewatching it before you and I talked, and it had been a while. And it's just so interesting how that period, like the early 2000s, so much comedy was based in this idea that like, we all understand that misogyny is bad and that racism is bad. Yes, so we can joke about it because we're post everything, when in fact, nah.
No, as we've seen, but yeah.
So there's a lot of, you know, the way they treat Christina Applegate's character in this movie is just horrible. And terrible. And they'd all be hopefully fired if any of that happened in 2024. But again, Paul Rudd has this quality that, like, of the, well, I'll put aside Brick, Steve Carell's character, because he just doesn't know what's going on at any point in time.
Yes, the pants
Ron and David Koechner's character and Paul Rudd's character. Paul Rudd is the one that you feel like, he doesn't really mean this.
Yeah.
Like, there's sort of this underlying thing where you just, like, he's being funny, but he doesn't really think this.
Yes. Yeah, he's kind of just, that's the environment, and he's sort of going along with it. Yeah, for sure. I think the scene that also kills me the most is the big fight between all the networks.
Yes.
Yes, when it just gets more increasingly ridiculous. You know, you get Luke Wilson's team, you get Ben Stiller, you get Tim Robbins. That's my favorite, you know, the public broadcasting. And yeah, it gets increasingly ridiculous. But I think Rudd, he's warm. He's kind of also, like you said, he's just going along with it. And he's also having so much fun just poking fun of that appearance thing, the suits, and, you know, just we're irresistible to women. So I know there's that joke that every movie is about, like, filmmaking and that kind of thing, but you can kind of see some of them really dig into these jokes because it does talk about their persona as movie stars at this point. Yeah.
I mean, again, I mentioned the Apatow movies, and those movies had wide appeal, but they were very bro-y. That was when the snack pack became a phrase, although Paul Rudd never was really part of that somehow.
No, like, he wasn't.
He was on,
like,
the outskirts of it. It was more like Vince Vaughn and
Will Ferrell, Owen Wilson.
And the Wilsons in general.
Yeah.
Anybody who was in Old School, you know.
Yes.
I love all those movies, but I feel like that could not last forever because it was too
of its time.
It was of its time, and there was way too much misogyny underneath the surface and some of those things.
Yes.
And,
yeah.
But I still appreciate them for what they are in the context of that time.
Yeah. And I think it's really interesting that you chose the next movie too. I Love You, Man, which is one I loved when I saw it I think I went to a couple of the critic screening just because I found it so funny, but it is sort of like, it's a bromance, yes, but it also deals with relationship issues. The women are interesting. I mean, it's from a man's perspective. Some of the female friendship stuff, it gets a little ridiculous, but I think it maybe treats the female characters a little bit differently, and also just has this sort of larger idea of how hard it is to make friends, especially in the once you get in your, like, post-college years, and in LA when everyone is spread out and kind of minding their own business and everyone is busy and they have their friendship groups. And I think making friends in adulthood is just super tricky, and it's gotten much worse by now. But I think this did kind of tap into the zeitgeist of that.
Yeah, for sure. And also just, I think how hard it can be sometimes for guys to make friends with each other, because I don't want to stereotype, because not every man is like that, but
no.
But there are a lot of men who have a hard time kind of opening up and being vulnerable with their guy friends. And this kind of captured that too. What's funny though, is that I remember seeing this and just absolutely loving it and thought it was terrific. And then last year I showed it to a bunch of people who either didn't remember it or hadn't seen it, and they did not like it very much.
Oh no.
And I think part of it is because what Paul Rudd does in this movie was so novel at the time, and we've now seen him do it a lot, that maybe because just the way he was playing awkward in this film, and just
it killed me back then, because
and just like
we all
just be like Jobin and say these weird words. What was it, something on the manje?
Later's on the menje.
Later's on the menje. And it was just so charming and so funny, and I don't know if all of those lines were improvised, I would guess that some of them certainly were. Mm-hmm. It just felt very much like this is his sensibility. And I think, not that, you know, Rashida Jones is great in it, Jason Segel's great in it, but to me, it's his movie.
Oh, God, yeah.
Because mm-hmm. it's completely his sensibility. And if you don't feel for him, you're not going to care about the movie at all. And you totally do, because he's so good.
Yeah. And he's also just, such a nice guy. And it points out the fact that not all men are the same type of man. And like you were saying, vulnerability, he's so vulnerable in this, and he doesn't know. He's someone who's a, they say, a girlfriend guy. And there is that kind of thing, like, oh, they got in a relationship and then they just like forgot their friends. And, you know, you kind of wonder, though, he's really tight with his mom, if he just didn't really bond with dudes that much. And some of the scenes kind of kill you, like when he has a fencing group and he does fencing, and then they're the whole rest of the team is going to go to Joshua Tree, and he makes like this U2 kind of this obvious joke, but it's cute, and how he's not invited. And it just, it shows you just the difficulty and the way it affects him, but he tries to like let it roll off his back. And yeah, I think it is his movie. It's great to watch him kind of come into his own and get excited mm-hmm. when he starts getting a friend, and his girlfriend is so supportive, but then, you know, Jason Segel is just the most ridiculous and gets like oversteppy, and it becomes a little clingy, like they're in a romance themselves. And so yeah, I think it's really wonderful. That's interesting, though. I like your point that maybe because that is what we then associated Rudd with, it wasn't as novel now. Yeah.
Yeah. Or maybe my friends were just not in the right mood for it. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
but they really gave me a hard time. Like, I can't believe Chaney chose that movie. I'm like, what do you mean?
Oh, no. Yeah. Well, I would have stuck up for you. I would have been like rolling on the floor.
It is interesting, though.
Yeah.
On that trip, I was the only woman. It was me and like several guy friends that had this response. So I don't know what that says.
Okay. Got you.
Maybe they were confronting vulnerabilities and they just couldn't deal with it.
Yeah. Oh, that's true. Yeah. And I love that too, because I am someone who, I'm usually like, there's a picture of me as a kid and it's my neighborhood friends and I'm the only girl in the group. And uh-huh. my dad likes to look back on it, and we're all in our Halloween gear. And he's like, yeah, this just foreshadowed Jen's friend groups. Like in the pandemic, I was the only girl. Megan Abbott is a friend in her group. She was the only girl too. So it's kind of that thing. So yeah, I think that's interesting that you picked this movie that you think, oh, my guy friends are going to love it. And yeah, and they did not. Yeah, that's really funny. I think I'm trying to remember. There's so many lines and scenes in this that I love. But the thing that stayed with me is when he's trying on a suit for the wedding and mm-hmm. Jason Segel is having him do, you know, James Bond. And he gets into Timothy Dalton, which is just kind of a joke. Like that's the Bond that he would go for. And Rudd just says T-Dalt instead of Timothy Dalton. For every time anyone has ever talked about Timothy Dalton after that, I hear T-Dalt in my head. So I'm just calling him T-Dalt now, but yeah.
I also love all the stuff with Rush and when they go to the Rush concert.
Oh my God. Yeah.
And Paul Rudd's character is trying to include Rashida Jones, but it's clearly like he and Jason Segel are like, this is our time.
Yes. Yeah. And I think we all know what that's like when you're trying to, you know, you got to listen to this, you know, music. You're going to love it. And you try to get into it. But yeah, it's a different thing.
This is from, you know, his era where he wasn't Ant-Man yet. Like,
no,
very handsome, but like, mm-hmm. he wasn't like ripped to the gills at this point. So he felt like, and it was appropriate. Like he, like you were saying earlier, like, yeah, he's a good looking guy, but he's not so like otherworldly that you couldn't imagine that maybe he's somebody that you would know or encounter in your daily life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And around this time, our next movie made 2 years later, Our Idiot Brother, found him back with Jesse Peretz, who's a friend. This movie I did not like the first time I saw it. I just didn't gravitate to it, but I watched it again when you chose it and I was like, you know what, it is cute. It's a funny idea of this very dysfunctional family with all these really strong women and just this one brother who keeps screwing up. I think it opens really hilariously when he's like at the farmer's market and this cop is asking him for drugs. It's basically entrapment, but you know,
100% entrapment.
Yeah.
He's like, and you need to pay me.
Yes. And then he goes, oh man, ha ha. And then he goes to jail. He makes these stupid decisions. But yeah, I love the cast in this. And I think it really benefits from the existing relationships he had with so many of these actresses. Yeah. So tell me about your relationship with this movie. Did you love it right away?
You know what? I actually hadn't watched it all the way through until I chose it. I just knew that it was a performance by him that was doing something different that I felt like we should zero in on.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah.
Like you said, it does reunite him with a number of people he's worked with before, like not half the cast of Parks and Rec, but a lot of people from Parks and Rec. Katherine Hahn is in this. Rashida Jones again is in this. Elizabeth Banks is in this as one of the sisters.
Yeah.
But what I like about the film is that based on the title and based on how it starts, you're like, oh, this guy is an idiot. As the title tells us, he's irresponsible. He doesn't have his life together. He's the problem. And slowly what you see is actually everyone else is the problem. He's the one who has a sense of integrity and decency to such a degree that he's completely naive. He's almost like a child in terms of what he's able to.
He's clueless.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And again, I think I keep coming back to this quality of the goodness in him, but you see it so full blast in this movie. His eyes are so innocent and open, and mm-hmm. and there's just such a kindness emanating from him, and you mm-hmm. feel it more and more as the movie goes on, and that's when you're like, oh wait, all of his sisters are terrible, and he's the only one with his heart in the right place.
Yeah, I know. I think that's such a good point. Like, as the movie goes on, and his life kind of keeps falling more and more apart. And he's a dog named Willie Nelson, which is cute. But and there's this whole thing about like the ex keeping the dog, and it's his dog, and you know, trying to steal the dog back. But as he winds up trying to figure out where to go, he bounces from house to house, and it's just really funny. It's kind of this Goldilocks thing where none of them really fit, and you're kind of like, they all grew up in the same house, which. Sometimes you meet siblings and they're totally different. You're like, you guys grew up in the same house and had the same experiences and just spiraled off and did completely different things. But I found that really interesting, seeing him in all of these different environments where he tries to fit, but he just can't relate to the way that they live their lives because he is naive and he's sincere and he wants to, you know, show love in weird ways, like showing inappropriate movies to the kids, or
I think the Pink Panther was perfectly appropriate.
I know. I think I saw it around that time too, but they like
overprotective.
Parents. Yeah. That was Emily Mortimer and was it Steve Coogan? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Which those two together was such a great dynamic in actors. I thought that was a really powerful duo. But then yeah, you get like and Rashida Jones again as the girlfriend. They're terrible. The sisters, you're pointing out that. And I think that's a really strong point. Yeah.
I mean, the other thing too is that I think it's fair to describe this as a comedy or maybe a dramedy.
Dramedy, yeah.
But at no point is Paul Rudd like essentially obviously playing it as a comedy. He's playing to character.
I agree with you.
The fact that it's funny is just because his character is funny. And he has this wonderful scene where he finally gets the whole family to sit down and they're playing charades and his sisters are being annoying. And they're like,
oh God, that's so bad with the kid. Yes.
Yeah. And he just has like a breakdown. He's like, I just want to sit with my family and play charades and enjoy each other. And it's it's such a simple request. And it's like, in that moment he has his priorities straight, but the way that he expresses that, you're just like, I don't know if you've had times in your life where you get upset about something that is technically minor, but you're upset about it because it's all this stuff underneath it. And that
it's
I felt
cumulative.
That so much.
Yeah.
I felt that so much in that scene. I thought he did such a good job of like, you know, making that clear to the viewer.
Yeah. No, I think that was a really good point. how kind of everything that has happened in this movie just comes to a head and comes out. And also it breaks your heart because it's a moment of frustration and a moment that kind of betrays everything we've seen with him. And you realize how he got to that point. Just like what you were saying, he doesn't play it as a comedy. He's playing just this man who happens to be in these situations. Because I think if you play the comedy, then that changes the tenor of the performance. And you're like winking. So it's better if you're just playing a guy. And that is what Paul Rudd's doing. There's a sensitivity there. And like you said, that innate goodness, which he has. Yeah.
And you could contrast that with like Wet Hot American Summer, where he's very blatantly playing smarmy comedy because it's a satire of a specific kind of
That's
thing
the
and it's
goal.
Supposed to be over the top.
Yeah, yeah.
And that speaks to another skill that he has, which is understanding tone and being able to calibrate based on, you know, slight shifts in what the tone might be.
Yeah. So this and I Love You, Man are more character-driven humor.
Yeah.
And then Wet Hot American Summer and Anchorman are the broad kind of going for it. Yes.
Yeah.
And knowing that you and the audience are on the same wavelength and you're on, you know, telling the same joke, basically. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then this sort of led up to his Marvel era. I got to be honest, I'm not a huge Marvel person. And when I watched when I watched Ant-Man for the first time, I completely fell asleep. I don't usually fall asleep in movies. I don't know what it was, but just I maybe got 20 minutes in and I was done. And then when I watched it again for this, I found myself, my mind just drifting again and again. And so there is something about this that just is confusing. And Jen, if you put a gun to my head, I don't think I could explain this movie. Like, it's so weird, but I love watching Rudd in it, and the actors are really good. Like, it's cool to see him with Michael Douglas. I love Corey Stoll, but Corey Stoll is one of those dudes, you put him in a movie, you're like, oh, he's going to be the bad guy, or he's going to die. Yeah.
Right. He's very good at being the bad guy.
I know. I
he's
love
excellent.
Corey Stoll. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I feel you on the Marvel thing. I remember when I saw it, what I appreciated was these little sprinkles of things that were not typically Marvel in it. Because Paul Rudd co-wrote the script. And as you may remember, Edgar Wright was originally supposed to direct it. And then
that's right.
He came off of it and Peyton Reed took over. But Edgar Wright had, you know, written some of the story. So there are moments in it that I thought were just really fun and whimsical that I felt like, oh, this was either Edgar's idea or Paul Rudd's idea. Like when there's the scene where he's shrunk and he's in a car and he's like jumping from a CD or a record or something like that, where I was just like, this feels very much of something that wouldn't necessarily be in a Marvel movie. and there are little moments where he'll do a line in a way that, like,
you need
you need his humor. Like there's a moment where he tells Michael Douglas he's going to get some tea and he's like, I'm just going to go get some tea. And he just does it in this way that makes you laugh. So I really like watched that movie and appreciated that aspect of it, like what he brought to it. I don't know if you watch the other Ant-Man movies at all.
No. Mm-mm.
Okay. If this one bored you, I invite you to watch Quantumania, the third Ant-Man movie, where every actor in it seems completely lost.
Oh,
and they're
no.
all great actors.
You
know, him, Michael Douglas, Michelle Pfeiffer, Bill Murray. But it's in that realm that they describe in the first Ant-Man, where there's no sense of like reality, and you can feel that they were acting in a void, a void of green screens, and so by comparison, the first Ant-Man is great.
Feels very fresh, and exactly, kind of like the original Iron Man movie or something, and then as these continue to go on, the various Avengers movies, you're just like, what am I watching? It's just completely all green screened, or some of the other spinoffs, Captain Marvel, that I didn't really get into.
I mean, and this at least has a bit of a human element, where so much of it is about his relationship with his daughter, and she's adorable, and you can tell that
I love the dynamic with the ex and Bobby Cannavale as the new, and I also thought it was kind of refreshing, like the new boyfriend isn't a bad guy, which is nice, because usually in these sort of like an Apatow comedy, he'd be an asshole. And, you know, he's not here. Yeah, he cares.
Right. Right. And by the end of the movie, you know, he and Bobby Cannavale and the daughter and Judy Greer, who plays his ex-wife, they're all
I love her.
Kind of like in a co-parenting situation, and being cordial with each other. And that was, I mean, it's a small thing, but like, it still sets an example of like, here's how
it should be.
A quote, broken family can evolve into.
Yeah.
But I also, I will say, like, the sort of underlying foundation for his character is that he was a burglar, but he's like a good kind of burglar who like,
that's really cool. Yeah. It's a Robin Hoodie kind of thing.
Yeah. But I still don't think, I can't imagine him being a burglar.
It was hard for me to imagine him being this like genius bank. Yeah. Burglar. Exactly. Like, I'm a robber. Yeah.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
But that's nitpicking, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. But Rudd is great. I think he brings a good energy to these movies that you do need, for sure. Just like some of the other actors did. Was it Captain America? Am I right on that? Chris Evans is good. You know, Thor, even though it started out very, very seriously, like some of the actors are really good in this series. And I think you need Rudd for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
Are there any other performances? Recently, I had on Susan Aliyah McNeil, the author. We did an episode on Kick-Ass Women, and she was talking about some of her World War II research and brought up Mo Berg and the fact that he played him in The Catcher is a Spy. The movie isn't great in itself, but Rudd is very strong in it. Mm-hmm. That's a good dramatic performance. It was kind of cool to see him do some of that. Like, you talked off air before we logged on that he kind of started out more dramatically and got comedically more film roles as he went on. But are there any other performances that really stick out for you that you'd recommend?
I mean, I don't know if this is legal since this is a podcast about movies, but he's been doing some good work on television.
Oh, go for it. Yeah. Yeah. Especially. We do TV sometimes for sure.
So he was in a show that it only was one season. And I don't feel like it was very widely watched, but I thought he did a great job in it.
Okay.
I'm trying to find the name of it. Okay. It came out in 2019 on Netflix. It was called Living With Yourself.
Okay.
And he plays, I'm trying to remember the premise, but he basically has to play like twins of himself. Like there's,
oh, wow. Oh, I heard he was really good in that. Yeah.
And he is, he's great in that. I also, I think he's wonderful in Only Murders in the Building.
And oh, yes. Yeah.
This is a little bit of a spoiler. He was in the third season, and as people probably know by now, his character is the murder victim in that, although they do flashbacks that keep him kind of coming back. But then he comes back in the fourth season as the stuntman for his previous character who died.
So that's so funny. Exactly like I haven't seen that one. Okay.
Okay, I'm sorry for ruining it for you, Jen.
Oh, no, not at all. It made me excited.
And he does an Irish accent, and I don't know this for a fact, but I'm convinced that it was Paul Rudd's idea because he loves the Irish.
Oh, yeah.
Many, many years ago, he got the, I guess it's called the Oscar Wilde Award. It's an award that they give out, or they used to anyway, like right before the Oscars, and they have a ceremony. And I was confused because I was like, Paul Rudd's not Irish. Like, his parents are British.
Are English. Yeah.
Yeah. And then he gave this just beautiful acceptance speech about his father, I guess, had done a lot of work in Ireland and had this great love for the Irish people to the point that he converted his basement in his house to an Irish pub.
Oh.
And his father had recently passed away, and he just gave this moving, moving speech. And I was like, God, that was amazing. And so I very briefly saw him afterward, and I was like, you know, I was confused at first when they were giving you this award. And he's like, well, now you feel pretty stupid, don't you? I'm like, yeah, pretty much. Nice talking to you. Bye.
No, oh, that's funny. I'm friends with Donald Logue, who loves Paul Rudd. And so that's interesting. Loves the Irish. They've been in stuff together. They were good friends. And Paul Rudd did show up in Donald's movie that he made, Tennis Anyone. Have you seen that one?
I haven't, no.
Okay.
But I should. It has tennis in the title.
Yeah. He wrote and directed it. It's just, it's a blast. And Paul Rudd's deal when he showed up was he wanted to play a porn star. And so he does these celebrity tennis tournaments, and he's like the most ridiculous porn star ever. And you could just tell, like, they probably could not stop laughing. I mean, you have like Stephen Dorff doing a Toby Keith type song that like Donald wrote really fast. That's hilarious. And you have, you know, Rudd as this porn star and stuff. So that's another thing. You brought up the Irish. So immediately I flashed to Donald because he talks about when they were starting out in the 90s, like hanging out and just doing With Nail and I lines all the time. And so I love that. I love his loyalty to all of his friends and how he will show up, just like you were talking about, this Venn diagram of people. Yeah. And they were in a bunch of like Jesse Parrott stuff together for sure.
Yeah. And I, you know, the state did a reunion tour last year.
Yeah.
And I went to see them a couple times actually. And I went in New York and Paul Rudd came to watch.
Oh, cool.
Them. Yeah. So it's like he really is very loyal.
Yes. Yeah, and you love that because they're all doing the same job and they're all working and it's a hard industry. And so it's good when they're not like petty and competitive and stuff like that. And yeah, so he seems to be doing more television. Any other things that you have found interesting about Paul Rudd that you want to share?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing this movie Friendship that he made with Tim Robinson, who does... I Think You Should Leave, which is a hilarious sketch comedy show on Netflix. I don't know much about it. I haven't seen it. I don't know if you have. I didn't go to any
of
those.
No.
But I love the idea of the two of them together just trying to like out cringe each other. I'm excited to watch that dynamic.
Yeah.
And then I have one more like Paul Rudd story if you want
to indulge
me. Absolutely.
Yes.
That just speaks to, I think, his character. So when I was trying to write my Clueless book, it was very stressful. I had like 6 months to write it, which is a very short period.
Oh my God, Jen. Yeah, because it's very, I mean, it's a long book and it's research oriented.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like tons of interviews. And so it was like 6 months to get the first draft done. And then as we were editing, I could still go back and put stuff in if I needed
to. Oh, good.
But even still, like that was not a long period of time. And I was really stressing out trying to get Paul Rudd. And, you know, at that time it was... He had made Ant-Man, but it hadn't come out yet. So this was going to be like a big moment for him. And his reps were like, I wouldn't say they were giving me the runaround, but they were making things kind of challenging.
Yeah.
And then one day, one of the assistants was like, Paul Rudd wants to talk to you. I'm like, okay, now? Like when is this happening? And then I just didn't hear anything.
Oh, wow.
And then one Saturday, middle of the day, like the phone rings. My husband answers the phone. He hands the phone to me. And it was Paul Rudd calling me from his house. He's like, I heard that you're writing this book.
Oh,
sorry if, you know, you've been having a hard time, but I'm happy to talk to you for it. And then I was like, well, do you have time now? And he's like, yeah. He's like, you probably need to get your notes together. I'll call you back in 10 minutes. 10 minutes on the dot, calls back, stays on the phone with me for like an hour and a half. Gives me like,
that's amazing.
Some of the best stuff that's in the book because he has an incredible memory. Like he remembered more detail than any of the other actors did.
Wow.
And I was just so grateful to him for doing that because at his level, like,
yeah,
a lot of people would not bother at all. And
no, and he's such a busy guy. Yeah.
And I could hear like his, you know,
his
it was actually the day that they were going to film the Saturday Night Live anniversary that night or something. And I could hear his kids in the background.
Oh.
They were like, he was talking to them and they were watching like Berenstain Bears or something. and I that has always stuck with me is like,
that's kind
of something to me about what a nice guy he really is. And I always like it when people say someone's nice and it turns out they really are.
They really are. Yes. No, that is so important. And I love that. And what I was, you know, thinking when I was listening to that wonderful story was, you know, you're doing the Vulture Festival and what we need to do, you mentioned the Henry Winkler acting lessons. We need to have you and the Paul Rudd experience where he brings on some of his collaborators and, you know, you facilitate, you moderate. Let's get this thing happening is what I'm saying.
Believe me, I have mentioned this idea every year, some form of it.
Okay.
But next year's the Clueless anniversary. So I feel like
It might happen.
Maybe.
Okay. Maybe change.org petition. We'll get it done. Yeah.
We're going to galvanize the people right here and now on the podcast and make it happen.
Exactly. All the 7 or 8 tennis fans and the people listening. Yes. No, well, Jen, this was such a pleasure. I want to thank you so much for doing this.
Oh, thank you for the invitation. It was really fun.
Of course. I also want to thank everyone for listening, especially my patrons who support the show and help fund my research, equipment, film rentals, RSS fees, and more for as little as $1 per month at the Film Intuition Patreon, which is the home base for the show. Other ways you can support the podcast are by sharing, reviewing, and subscribing to Watch with Jen wherever you get your podcasts, and also checking out the cool merch store hosted and created by our talented logo designer, Kate Gabrielle. You can find the merchandise store, including shirts, tote bags, stickers, and more by visiting filmintuition.com and clicking on the shop link. The show's theme music is Solo Acoustic Guitar by Jason Shaw and is available in the Free Music Archive. You can also reach me or interact with Watch with Jen anytime on Twitter, either at Film Intuition or our Watch with Jen account as well. Well, until next time, please take care and happy movie watching. This is Jen Johans at filmintuition.com and Film Intuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen.